Hello, beautiful friends, and greetings from the Atypical Behavior Analyst, your place in space to hear conversational information about the science of behavior analysis. I am your host, Kelly, and welcome to episode 45. But before we jump into today's episode, let's go over some quick housekeeping. So first off, we're ACE approved. If you're listening for continuing education units, jot down the two keywords interspersed during the talk, and then take those over to our website, atypicalba.com, where you can purchase CEUs. And then take a little bit of time to cruise around the site to find additional resources for each of our episodes and more information about our fantastic guests. Next, if you'd like to stay up to date with upcoming talks and live events, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our lives are a fantastic time to hang out, learn, and interact with our guests, and our social media is a great way to get to know the podcast, so reach out and say hello. You can also rate and provide feedback on your favorite listening platform to help further our dissemination mission. And lastly, stick around after the talk to hear a preview clip from episode 46. And now, today's knowledge. We're going to be putting on our theory and philosophy hats for this one. In this live talk with Kelly Sisson-Snyder, MS, artist, writer, and aggression consultant, we are going to discuss the concept of reinforcement, constructional aggression training, and art in the behavioral sciences. Kelly worked with shelter animals in private practice, and her application of negative reinforcement to teach consent and approach behaviors with aggressive dogs was groundbreaking, especially when it came to the concept of reinforcement. Utilizing the constructional approach, Kelly was able to create the technique that was successful because it incorporates the critical consequence, what's already reinforcing the behavior, instead of forcing the pairing of a new consequence when the animal isn't ready. So adjust your speakers and tune into episode 45, Learning to be Constructional Through Art and Animals with Kelly Sisson-Snyder. All right. Hello, friends, and welcome to the Atypical Behavior Analyst. I am your host, Kelly, and it's Thursday. We're doing a Thursday one this week, so that's exciting. We actually have another one tomorrow, but that means nothing if you are listening at a later date, so it's fine. But today is going to be super fun because we're extending more of this conversation with utilizing the constructional approach, the science of behavior analysis with different organisms. And in this case, we're looking at animals, shelter dogs, and then also looking at the behavioral artistry of things and how that creativity really is part of the science as well. And we can utilize it and we can build it. And it's just a really kind of cool component. So we're going to get super nerdy and, you know, some philosophy and yeah, it's going to be fun. So I am with Kelly Sisson-Snyder. It's always fun to say your name fast. Another Kelly. I always appreciate it. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. We've known each other for a long time and it's been a long time since we've been able to hang out. So I'm glad that we get to do this.
Well, thanks for having me. This will be great.
Yeah. So if you could kind of give a little bit of your background, both in the animal world and the behavior world, and then we'll kind of jump in from there.
Well, I guess it all started back in the 90s when I started, I had a cockatoo and she was aggressive to me and I wasn't involved in any form of behavior training yet, but she would bite the holy snot out of me and she adored my husband. So I had a problem and by sheer luck, it was back in the 90s. So you can imagine the state of the internet at that point, but by sheer luck, I happened across this listserv group where there were some clicker trainers, professional clicker trainers that did a bird show. And they coached me through email, strictly by email, how to work with my bird. Now, it wasn't, in a way it was constructional, but it wasn't constructional in the way I use it now. But through the course of our interactions, they recommended that I read Don't Shoot the Dog by Karen Pryor. I read it like five times. And then I was like, okay, what else can I read? I read everything I could find. And Marion Bailey was on that listserv. She worked with Skinner in Skinner's lab and had animal behavior enterprises with her first husband. Anyway, she recommended that I look up Jesus at the University of North Texas, which I did. And I decided, you know what? I live right here in the DFW area, so I might as well go to school at UNT, which I did. At that point, I had not finished my bachelor's, so I finished that up and went into the master's program. And as soon as, well, and my work was on the constructional approach to dealing with canine aggression. And then as soon as I graduated, I landed this job at the SPCA of Texas, which started a whole career in shelter behavior. And I think that's the end of that part of my story.
So before we jump into kind of the behavior side of it, what was the draw to aggressive dogs? Because I mean, most people don't go in and want to do like, hey, it's going to bite me, or they're going to be put down if we don't do something. It's a pretty...
Well, I'm an idiot. That's the first thing. Actually, what happened was, you remember we had the Orca labs at UNT, the training labs, and I was in that. And Jesus said, one week at our meeting, he said, is anybody interested in doing the constructional approach with aggressive dogs? And I was like, I'm like looking around the room and there's all these much younger people and all of them are like, no, thank you. I raised my hand. I'm like, I'll do it. Cause it was like, that sounds interesting. And the rest is history. I got so into it. It was really, it was dangerous, but I live to tell the tale and here I am. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool. So explain a little bit about CAT. I always like saying it's CAT for dogs. Makes me laugh. So kind of like what that approach was and, you know, how it's constructional and then utilizing those components of behavior analysis. So like, so as you saw in the learning objectives, you know, reinforcement as a concept and not just as like a treat or a click.
Right. That was a little strange because, you know, up to that point, my training had been strictly with a clicker and with positive reinforcement. It's like they do what you want or they do an approximation of what you want, you deliver. So it's always like, it was like a very physical change. Initially, it was like, you go through these years. By the time I was doing the aggression work, I'd been in the training world for 6 or 8 years. So maybe not quite that long. Anyway, I had some time in the training world. And I'm trying to formulate a direction to come at this. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I totally gave you like three different prompts. Good luck with that. No. So let's start with what is CAT? Let's start there.
Let's start there. Yeah. So the constructional aggression treatment was basically a name we chose to call this procedure. And what we did, well, as you know, the constructional approach refers to teaching a new repertoire, that giving them more things that they can do in a situation that are not problematic. So with aggressive dogs, kind of my research, this was my thesis project as well as the work I did later. So basically what we did was ask what would happen. We know that if a dog barks and lunges at a person, a dog, a stranger, that stranger typically goes away or stops what they're doing or changes what they're doing in some way. So we wanted to evaluate whether the dog was experiencing reinforcement from this action, or whether, as most dog trainers think, or thought at the time anyway, whether it was strictly respondent, stimulus response behavior. Because that's how we were taught to do classical conditioning, you know, respondent conditioning, and desensitization with these guys. And so we were like, maybe we can do something operant. Well, looking at it, basically, what a lot of training procedures do is when a dog behaves aggressively, the owner will cue it in some way. They usually want the dog to look at the owner and get a treat. But our thinking was that dog's big motivation in that moment is not pepperoni. It is that other thing is worrying me and I need it to go away. So I, for whatever reason, the dog has figured out that barking and lunging chases it away. Maybe it was initially a respondent behavior and they just kind of reflexively did it. But for whatever reason, it has stuck in their repertoire. So we wanted to measure and see if by changing the outcome, putting the outcome that they were already working for, which was distance from the aversive stimulus, if we put that outcome on preferred behaviors. So instead of having the bad guy go away when he's lunging and barking, the bad guy would stay in place until they did anything else that wasn't dangerous. And so when they automatically sat and looked at their owner, we would go away. When they just turned their head the opposite direction, we'd go away. And that's basically it. We taught them these alternative behaviors that they could do that were not only effective, but they were easier to perform than all that aggression. So we gave them an easy task that they could do instead of aggression in order to get the bad guy to go away. And we consistently changed their behavior from aggression to these other kinds of behaviors. And in the majority of cases, we were able to switch them over to friendly behaviors.
That was my next question, was like, so from there, it's one of those, now that the dog is actually calm, you can work on building that approach in. So yeah.
Yeah. So basically what that, we called it the switchover. And that was a part that we didn't get into research about. But we saw it again and again and again. After we had done this, it was like the animals had, they were like, oh, here's the way I thought of it, my very anthropomorphic way. But it was like they were looking at me and going, she gets me. She understands. She's going away. She must be cool. And then they would start to approach me in a friendly way. So I was usually the stranger in the research phase of things, because I didn't want to deal with other people. Well, you know, it's like, I'm like, it's this dangerous situation. You've got an aggressive dog, and I would rather me be the one that was standing in front of an aggressive dog than asking a grad student, you know, another student to do it. Later on, I worked with professional dog people, and all sorts of people did it, but that was what we did at first.
That's nice of you. So
I involved my son in one of them. He was like 18 at the time, and he was my cameraman, and he ended up doing some of the work with me, and it worked. It was like the dog was like, well, you've been here the whole time, so you're pretty easy. And he ended up, that dog ended up being friendly with both of us before we left that day.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was very cool.
Yeah. And it's such a pretty thing to watch too. Because you do kind of see that switch in the dog's response of, it is, it's like, oh, I can trust you now because you actually are doing what I want you to do.
Yes, that's kind of, yeah, that's a good way to put it. That was the feeling I got. It was like at first when the first time they did something neutral and we would walk away, I would look back and they would be going, what are you? No, let me try that again. And it would not work again. And they would tilt their heads and they would like, it's like this human doesn't work like normal. So of course, then there's a lot of generalization and stuff you have to do to make it translate to the big world. But it was quite effective.
Yeah.
Still is. I don't know why I said it in the past tense.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I've actually used it with some of my clients. I have one individual who his way of like, he does not like my computer being out because that means I'm there and that means I'm still there. So I started just not ever taking my computer out. And then he would sit at the table with us and be like, hey, can I take this out? And if I got a, you know, yes response, then okay, cool. I would take it out and I tell him just for a little bit. But the first time that he would reach over, it's like, oh, do you want me to put it away? Cool. Let me save this real quick. I'm all done. And now it's one of those. Yeah. I can actually sit for like 15 minutes with my computer open and he just hangs out and it's great.
That's awesome. It's like, it gives them control of their, you know, because, and when you're talking about children with disabilities, dogs, you know, captive animals in zoos, they don't have a lot of control over a lot of things. In fact, you know, my work is with mostly domestic animals, and dogs these days, even compared to 20, 30 years ago, they're on leashes, they're in fences. They never get to be out in the world and make choices for themselves. They never, ever, ever do. And so sometimes just that lack of opportunity to choose what's going to happen to them. When I was traveling in Ecuador, we would see tons and tons of street dogs. You know, they're everywhere. And you really didn't see them fighting, because what would happen was, you know, one dog would be doing its thing over here and it would notice this other dog's walking down the street and they would get out of the way. They would move away. They would make another decision that didn't cause a fight. Because when you think about it, fighting is really energy expensive. It costs a lot of energy and it costs a lot of effort. And they need to be preserving their effort and energy for acquiring food and begging at the market and taking care of their offspring. And that, and, you know, they walk miles and miles a day. So when you think about how a dog would live if it were left to its own devices, it has a lot more choices. It may not choose to be around people, because typically these days people will catch them and try to save them from their horrible life on the street, which I could talk about in another podcast someday. But the dogs are, you know, in some places, like up in the Andes, where the weather is always great, they're living a great life. But our dogs, they're living in our pampered households with all the stuff that we give them. They don't get to choose what they're going to eat. We give them a certain amount of food of a certain kind, usually the same exact kind, every single day. There's just no choices in their lives. And so that little opportunity to have choice is enormous. It's just enormous.
So I want to touch on the question that's in the chat right now, because I think it kind of falls in, you know, with these learning histories. Oh, no, it's fine. That's what I do. So looking at using, you know, those critical consequences and everything. So how would it work with the previous learning history when of looking at the owner for food? So you mentioned, you know, that's a lot of times the cue that gets given. And so, because now if you're not providing that, you're bound to see some form of extinction. So how did you utilize that?
Well, that it can be tricky. I will tell you my dirty little secret, which is that the hardest dogs to work with belong to trainers. And that's because the trainers have tried everything already, and the dog has a ton of different, they've had all the consequences. You know, in some cases, they've had aversive and positive reinforcement consequences. It can be tricky. I'll give an example of a human. When I worked briefly with children with autism at a preschool, and I had a kid who, bless his heart, his parents were divorced. His mother was extremely loving and doting. And every morning she would drop him off at school and go to the bathroom and cry and then go to work. So then there's Dad. On Dad days, Dad was really harsh, really punitive. He would spank him. He would do all this stuff. So here's this kid. He's like in mom's house where mom is like hanging on by a thread. He's at Dad's house where the least little thing will get him punished. He's at school where we have these completely different set of rules. He knew all the different things he could try. And if he got frustrated, he would just pee on you or something. You know, if he was just, he's like, I don't know what you want, so here, I'll pee on you. And who could blame them? It's kind of the same thing with dogs. It's like, you know, I don't know what to do. So basically what I would do with those guys is if I wanted, you know, if I'm going to work with them, I'm probably going to use a constructional approach, maybe with a little bit of classical conditioning and stuff thrown in at times. But I would intersperse my trials. Like if I'm having, you know, if I'm having someone approach and go away, like in between, I might have the owner go to the side and go, have them do some simple behaviors or some favorite behaviors that I can reinforce with treats with, and then have the treats have nothing to do with the helper, with the decoy, so that we kind of separate that reinforcement out a little bit. So that was typically what, that's typically what I would recommend is something like that. And, you know, this is something that you and I, Kelly, were talking about a little bit earlier, which is that I apologize. I've lost my train of thought because things were popping up on my screen and I'm a dope sometimes.
That's okay.
So let's get back on track here.
So going over like, making sure that those cues and the contingencies stay very clear of each other. And then also this concept of choice and building trust and everything.
Yeah, the choice issue, a lot of the ways we introduced that was in this context of avoiding extinction. You know, it's always a matter, and if when you're trying to minimize extinction, you always want to keep your rate of reinforcement high, 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 so that there's, and in the case of cat, we did not just reinforce one behavior. In fact, for a while, when I first started out, I reinforced a lot of head turns, and I was working with this one dog. It kind of cracks me up when I think back on it, but the dog had gotten, she'd like, oh, if I turn my head, she'll walk away. So she would look at me and she very dramatically turn her head and walk away. Well, she started turning her head, keeping her eye on me and barking to the side like that. And so I had the two behaviors tied together, the barking, the staring, and the turning the head. So at least I had the head turn, but what I realized was I have to do more. I have to reinforce a greater variety of options for her so that, and just not if she's barking, zero reinforcement, but I need to find something else to reinforce as quickly as possible so that I don't give her a chance, so to speak, of going into a big extinction burst.
That's funny how behaviors get linked like that.
Yeah, it was hilarious. And it was like one of those things. It's like, what is happening here? It wasn't until Jesus and I were looking at the video later and I'm like, oh, I see what happened there. It was
getting a side eye from a dog.
Yeah, with barking and turning the head. It was pretty funny. But yeah, that is basically, it can be tricky. One of the things that was really challenging with dogs that had previous training histories was that the norm is for the dog to be taught to be calm or to be still. And what this does is it doesn't teach them to feel any different about the situation. It just means they get still. So with those dogs, a lot of times they will not respond aggressively. They will just lay there doing nothing until you're close enough, and then they'll lunge. And so it's because it's all about stimulus control. They learn that I'm going to get reinforcement for laying still, for being calm. We presume it's calm. It's not always calm if they're still. And so they are like, okay, I know she's over there. I'm on a leash. I can't reach her to bite the snot out of her. She's going to keep bothering me. So I'll just wait and bide my time. So that was a little tricky because they were so good at that sometimes that I could be doing cat and not really tell what was going on with them. So what I started doing was, instead of reinforcing anything calm, I reinforced appropriate movement. So standing up, getting up from laying down to standing up, but not in a, you know, there's this one kind of getting up where they're laying down, they see something they don't like, and they're suddenly up and barking. There's that. But I would be looking for, oh, I'm just going to get up in a casual way. My body language is loose. Lots of looking at body language. I would be looking for anything loose and moving, walking, anything like that, that was just loose and had movement in it. And I would reinforce that instead of calm, because calm is not readable. I loved working with dogs that were really put on a big show, lots of barking and lunging, because I can deal with, you know, we set up the safety environment so that nobody got hurt, the appropriate gear, put them behind a fence, whatever was appropriate for their stimulus conditions, that for their environment that we needed to work in. And that really helped significantly. A lot of times it was hard to get the ones that had learned to be still, calm and still. It was hard to get them to move because they had their stillness so strongly reinforced in some cases. The easiest dogs to work with are the ones who'd never worked with anybody before, who had never been trained before, because they didn't have all this learning history of things that had to be unlearned. So I was always excited. And I was like, when I had on my questionnaire, when I was doing this as a private practice, it would say, have you trained with anyone else? Has your vet done anything, you know, like all that. And when it was like, nope, I was like, yes, we'll have a good time here. Because it was like, you've got all this behavior to work with. I don't want them leaping and growling and barking, but you know, I can see that they're doing that. So I'm like, okay, I don't reinforce that. What becomes a problem with the calm behavior is they may be still having all these emotions and not doing anything. So if I'm just seeing stillness, and I think stillness means we're doing good, then I get too close and they're still having all the same emotional conflict inside their heads that they were having before, but I can't see it because it's inside them. It's a lot more dangerous. So.
Well, it's an extinction burst, because if I've been reinforced by staying calm by this person going away, and now you're approaching, that reinforcement of you leaving's never, you know, it's still coming at you. And so of course it's like, okay, well now you're here and I don't want you to touch me. So what's my last resort? I know for a fact this one, you know, that's why I'm doing a chomping motion.
It always works with the teeth or the threat of teeth. But yeah, it was like, that was with these dogs that had been trained to be calm. I would look for an eyebrow moving or just a repositioning of a foot or anything that involved movement, especially if they got up and it wasn't a sudden lunge from the ground. If they got up and they were just like this is a weird situation. I'm okay with that. You know, that can be an approximation to getting to the finish line.
It's so cool to watch too. Because like when we had our discussion with the constructional affection training, it's not like this takes trials and trials and days and weeks. Like it's, I mean, how long were your sessions typically? And then when did you start to see that real shift in behavior?
It varied quite a bit. And the things that vary, the difference seemed to be things like what we were just talking about, the training history of the animal. The very first dog I worked with before we had it really into a procedure, I had a little dog, aggressive dog, in a room with five other dogs the same day off leash. And that was several hours of work. One of my early cases was a dog who'd never been worked with before. It took 45 minutes and of active work, trials. So it was like, basically we would set up a, there's a huge side of this that we haven't really touched on, which is the stimulus control, the environmental conditions that you set up. And so we would work from a distance, and we have to figure out where the aggression occurred. Ideally, we would work with, whenever possible, we would work in the situation where the aggression normally occurred, or in the situation that was the most problematic for the owner. Because when you're working with an owner or a caregiver, you've got to please them early. It's ideal to please them early to give them some relief, because, you know, there's a reason they're calling for your help. You're the expert, and you want to recognize that it may be the dog that has the problem, but the owner has the problem, and having an aggressive dog is not fun. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we do the work in a situation that will give them some early relief. And so in that case, we worked in the living room because we tried doing it outside, and he was like, I don't mind, you can hang around. We did it in the backyard, the front yard, down the street. Nothing worked except the living room, and she's like, well, that's pretty true. When the doorbell rings, that's when all hell breaks loose. So he was easy. We worked with him. He was the time my son was with me doing the camera work. And it took about 45 minutes for him to literally be coming up for petting from me. Then we switched it over to my son, who, and I took over the camera, and he did it. Now, he'd been present the whole time, so the dog was familiar with him. Took like 20 minutes for him to be able, for the dog. Now, we don't, you know, I used to approach the dogs. Nowadays, I let the dogs do all the approaching. So that I can watch their body language and make sure. I've been lucky not to be maimed very many times. but then I brought in, about 3 weeks later, I brought in another student from UNT, and she was able, he was really initially aggressive with her when we first went to the door. He remembered me and he was fine with me. But he didn't know this new girl. So we worked for another 20 minutes and he was fine with her too. And so that was kind of how we just kind of kept introducing people. That was the generalization process for him. But like I said, he was super easy. He had not, the family, whenever company had come over, they'd pop him in his crate in the bedroom. And while that's not what they wanted, he was great with them, that poor family, they went on separate vacations because there was no one that would board him. So it was bad. But he was pretty easy to work with, and generalization went really nicely. But then there have been other dogs. One time I had this client, or I never actually made her a client. She's a school teacher. She called me, "I've got an aggressive dog, I need some help." So I send her my questionnaire, which was fairly detailed. You know, where does the aggression happen? It's towards dogs. What breed is he? He's a pit bull. I saw lots of pit bulls. The main problem with pit bulls is that they're so strong. They're just freaking strong. And so you've got to like double down on your safety. Anyway, I got all the information. We exchanged several emails when I had clarification. Then we had our meeting. We decided we were going to meet in this one place in a park. And I would bring my dog, since he was aggressive towards other dogs. I had a greyhound that I worked with back then. And so we got him, we used two leashes and attached him to this metal. Oh, the first thing that happened with that dog, I arrived and we're supposed to be in this one place in the park in Denton. It was a place in Denton. They had him in the dog park, in the middle of the dog park, with his muzzle hanging around his neck. And I'm like, what is he doing in there? She had him in that little exercise, that area in between the two, the little dogs and the big dogs. I'm like, he should never be in there. Let's get out. So we got him out. We go down the road down to where we were supposed to meet. And I'm like, this isn't good. And then I get my dog out. And after we got him all leashed up and everything, because he was a moose, he was a big bucket of muscles, he was really powerful, and he had this yellow eyes, and I don't know, anyway, so he's just kind of sitting there, standing there like, I'm just a guy, I do my thing. And he did get growly. I bring my dog out, she walked like two steps and refused to move. She would not take a step. And I'm like, you know what? Let's regroup. I pop her back in the car. And I was like, she is seeing something. And I was having some red flags too, but she had the biggest red flag because she was like, nope, not doing it. I am not going anywhere near that guy. And she'd never done that before to me. So I said, put your dog back in your car. Let's have a little bit more of a conversation. And when she got her dog back in the car, she told me, this was my ex-husband's dog. He raised fighting pit bulls, and this dog's been in three fights. And I was like, we went through this. We asked all these questions. What is, you know, what's your dog's history? She had not mentioned a bite history. She hadn't met. And I, you know, and I was like, you didn't tell me all this stuff about this dog. You put me and my dog in danger. And I was like, I'm afraid this is the end of the road for us. It was just like, so there's, you know, and you guys have this issue too, but it's like the issue of the owner/parent, the, if you can't trust what the parent's telling you or the owner is telling you, then you've got a training issue too, because that's a whole different teaching and learning situation, because it cripples the learner as well as the trainer, the person that's there to help. So anyway, that was,
it's that consideration of, like, you know, trauma. And I've had a lot of families that I've worked with in the past, and staff, depending, you know, they don't want to bring up these aversive situations that have happened in the past, because, like, oh, it's just really sad and depressing. But it's like, but that's important. Like, that's pertinent, yes, information that has rewired your brain. Like, neurologically, your brain is different having gone through those things. And it's the same with animals. You know, I mean, it's a, yes, you know, the dog is either, if they're a bait dog, they end up having a certain response classes. But if they were a fighting dog, then there's a whole different set of response classes.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the whole thing. We did a lot of information gathering about their history, and it was absolutely essential to have anybody working with canine aggression. If they're not doing that, they should be doing that. We need to have all that background information to kind of start figuring out, were they abused? Is this something they figured out on their own? In one case, I had an owner who would do the, oh, poor baby routine every time the dog behaved aggressively. And it's like, well, perhaps if you didn't do that at quite that moment, and the owner's like, but she's so worried and scared. And I'm like, yes, she really is. It's great that you understand that. Let's figure out a way that we can reinforce something besides aggression. in her case, and in most people's cases, there was nothing but good intent. They wanted to do the right thing by their dog. And, you know, how many students did I get from, they watched the Cesar Millan show, The Dog Whisperer, on TV, got tons of clients that way. There were a couple of local trainers in Dallas that, oh, I was going to so-and-so, and he just got worse. And I'm like, oh, I don't doubt it. I've heard this story before. And it's because they're using shock collars or a lot of aversive punishment techniques. And the dog, it's like, you've got a dog who's already worried about something in the environment, and you're going to shock him? That's like, that's what you're going to do? And it's very predictable that that's where their behavior is going to end up. But I made some money off of those guys, but it really sucked because the dogs were so, it was just so unfair to them.
Punishment works. It's one of those, it's a fact. Like, we can knock out behaviors with punishment. It's not a hard thing to do, but then you're missing that whole component of, but what are you building instead? And if all you're doing is punishing, then the animal will freak out eventually. I mean, you can see humans that do that. You continuously tell a person no, 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 no. And again, it's that extinction burst. I'm not coming in contact with what it is that I want. And I'm going to bite you, or I'm going to punch you in the face, or.
Yeah. Or, you know, it's just like you get learned helplessness where they're just like, oh, screw it. I'm going to get shocked anyway. Why should I try? And then you've got the counter control where it's like, I'm going to wait until I have a chance and I can get you back, or redirection. Like, I can't get you back, but I can certainly attack the cat and that sort of thing. So it's like, it just sets up so many complications. And I totally get why people go with that. Well, I have a couple of things. People are desperate. When people have an aggressive dog, they're usually pretty desperate to find a solution. And so they look online and they look for the coolest ad, like the ad that says, I can fix your dog for, you know, hardly any money. Well, sometimes it's a whole lot of money, but I can fix your dog guaranteed. And they're like, yes, I'm going to call them up and go over there, because they don't know anything about behavior training. So they go over there, you know, they may do a board and train where they keep them away from you for a few weeks and have a shock collar on them. They don't know. Now, not all board and trains are like this. There are many, many, many good board and trains out there. But there are some where you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes, and there's typically a lot of punishment. You get a dog back that's either shut down, or they're... the stimulus conditions are different. You're back home. So they go back to how they were behaving before. So it's, there's that people are, they're looking for, they need us to advertise that we can do that. It's like, I learned how to deal with this behavior and I'd love to show you. We need to be doing that. But we're instead going out as dog trainers, we have this little community of science-based dog trainers, and we go out there and go, we're going to teach you some science-based dog training. And they're like, I don't want a stinking science class. I want to learn how to get my dog to act different. I want him to stop biting people. That's what I want. I don't want to go to a science class. So we need to be able to go in there, communicate with the owner, and really work on the specific problem that they have, which is in my history, in my work, dogs that behave aggressively, they bark, they lunge, they growl, they knock grandma down, they scare people, they bite. And we need them to stop doing that. And that's another thing. People look at it like, I want my dog to stop being aggressive. So you'll ask them invariably, what's the problem that you're here to see me about? You know, what's the issue? I want my dog to stop behaving aggressively. It never occurred to them that we need to not just stop them, which is, you could do that with a shock collar. You can stop them, but we need to teach them what can they do instead. Give them a bigger repertoire. Teach them what they can do that will be safer, that will work better in their environment, and that in many cases can be a lower response cost or lower cost expense for them. And so the easier behavior that still works is going to get the most use. So that's why reinforcing a head turn is great. Dog turns his head, I walk away, but then I want to mix it up. I want him to have as many alternative behaviors that are appropriate as possible. I don't want to teach him, in my opinion, just teaching him to look at me and ask me for information, which is understandable. I want there to be some of that. I want him to be tuned into me. But I also want him to be able to make choices on his own about what behavior to perform that's going to be effective. So during the training process, I want to give him as many options as possible so that he sees that turning the other way, sitting, laying down, licking his paws, whatever, is going to be easier and work at least as well, and ideally maybe better than lunging and barking and growling, which takes a lot of energy and changes your emotional state. I know we're not supposed to say that word.
No, because this whole time I've had Izzy in the back of my head, and the whole, do you feel fear because you see the bear? Is it, you have fear, and that I always get it wrong. But it's that, it's, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, a lot of these things have developed potentially because it was respondent. It was, you know, a traumatic environment or traumatic learning history. And then over, and probably not even over time, but like, you learn pretty quick what works.
Yes. And that's the whole thing. It's like, it probably did start out in some sort of respondent, whether they were just startled by a scary guy that walked around the corner, or, you know, some sort of susceptibility to reinforcement, which is what Skinner called it. He said every learner has a susceptibility to reinforcement. That's going to be different, but it depends on what the actual reinforcer is and where it, how it's delivered as to whether they're going to respond to that. So a certain dog may have a greater sensitivity to reinforcement with distance, but it's not until the situations arise for that to happen in that you're going to recognize it.
So taking it that one step forward, so we've you know, started to teach the dog, you can do these other behaviors in order to get me to go away. But at the same time, you're kind of building in that switchover of now we're going to work on approach and remaining calm during that time. But like the next step would be, what kind of tools are you giving the pet parent, in this case, to take with them? So, because it's not just the generalization of bringing new people in all the time or new dogs, but also like this human now has to maintain those contingencies in order for that behavior to continue to maintain.
Yeah.
So what was that process?
So we want to, this was, that aspect of stuff was something that got developed further as I was out in the world. So there are things that I need to, do to help them just cope in the world. So I also teach them some management behaviors, like there's a U-turn. I want to be able to teach them, I'm walking down the sidewalk, you're on leash, I see something that's potentially problematic up ahead, and I want to have a cue on board that can say, where I can see that dog up there, and I know that we're not ready to face that dog, so I can say, turn around, and we'll turn around and go the other way. And I want the dog to have so much fun turning around with me, because the treats are going to be delicious and all that kind of stuff, that it's always a good opportunity. I mean, it's always a good idea to turn around with me. And ideally, that means that the owner has to be really tuned in. The owner can't just be on their cell phone, doing Facebook while they're out with their dog, because they have a reactive dog. Honest to God, you've got a different set of responsibilities there. So I teach them several things like that. Do a U-turn, face me. Like there's sometimes when if he's looking at me, he's not going to be doing the other things, like scanning the crowd for somebody that he doesn't like, you know. Teach him that, you know, if I'm approaching someone that looks like they might be a problem, I can say, look at me and turn them to me, so that I have a second to scan the area and figure out what I'm going to do instead of approaching this person. And then I work with them when we get to the, some of the first things I do are teach them skills like that, like the U-turn and the look at me and that kind of stuff. Then I work on having them work with friends that will, you know, like just keeping the friend at a distance, but letting the dog check somebody out from a distance. And then when the dog does something that's appropriate, we casually turn the other way, maybe get a treat, depending on what the situation is. But I teach them a lot of things like that. I let them know that they might run into situations in the world that we have not prepared for. So they need to be aware. And if something pops up, they can always call me. But if they don't try to just power through anything, always try to use some of these other things. But the training itself is teaching them the world isn't always going to kill you. So there are ways, if you do this other thing, then this other thing is going to happen. And then give the owner some good handling skills so that they can manage a situation or divert a problem, ideally divert a problem or solve a problem. Sometimes you just have to cut your losses because the dog's not ready for a situation or a big surprise happens, and you kind of have to cut your losses and get safely out of the situation. So there's a lot of training about stuff like that too.
That's why I like to do like debriefings after like any kind of big event happens, because you can start talking through, and again, trying to teach myself not to use the science class, even though I really want to talk about it as a science, you know, let me tell you the stimulus control that was potentially going on. No, they don't want to hear that. What they want to hear is, okay, this is what went well. This is what didn't go well. This is the consequence. So what are we going to do differently? What do we need to be more observant with?
Oh, yeah.
Because especially as the human who is in control all the time, I say this as both cats have now approached me, I am no longer in control. That's my water. Sorry, guys. I didn't put the lid on it and it's about to be catted if I'm not careful. So, but, you know, being able to provide those alternative tools and being able to give them, you know, we want to create their own contingency analyst, essentially. Like, I want you to be able to look at the situation and be observant. But yeah, life's going to happen. You know, another dog's going to pop out from the side that has never been there before, or a squirrel runs in front of you or something. And so teaching people, I think, to have that moment of like, okay, you know, how did you respond in this situation? How did you feel in control and not in control? And then how do you think your dog feels in control and not in control? So yeah, as the ones that are in control, it's really important to make sure that, you know, they're also not being reactive as the human.
Yeah. And that's so easy for them to go into. I totally get it. Where they get reactive, if they're like freaking out, then that's when we get a lot of yanking on the leash, dragging the dog, understandably. And sometimes you have to do stuff like that because it's like, there's going to be a fight. We've got to get out of here. Or there's a dog off leash or something. And you've got to have physical control when it comes to dogs. Usually it's legally required anyway in most cities. So, so teaching the handler skills. A lot of, I'll tell you, the majority, I would say the easy majority of dog trainers that specialize in aggression or stuff like that have had an aggressive dog. There's like, you just don't, I'm probably one of the few that went into dog aggressions without having an aggressive dog. I did have an aggressive parrot though, so I got it. Having an aggressive thing in your household is not fun. It's pretty miserable and dangerous, and it's a liability, a potential homeowner's or renter's liability. You can be forced to give up a pet or have a pet euthanized, and so, you know, we have to educate the owners. And frankly, the owners that really don't, as I was saying before, we want to make sure that we don't scare them off too early in the situation by saying it's going to be a boring science class. But we do need to bring them into the realization that you're going to have to kind of become an expert on your dog's aggression. And so it's like, you may not have to be an expert on all dogs' aggression, but you need to be an expert on this dog's aggression, and help them come into the kind of more advanced handling skills and more advanced understanding of behavior. Whether we do that by carefully avoiding jargon, or whether I think it's ideal to gradually introduce it as new concepts that are helpful in their situation. So, because I have a lot of feeling in my heart for these pet owners. I worked with one woman. She had this gorgeous Ridgeback that she had got to be a show dog. And when it was like 6 months old, there was a trainer that hung it up by its neck because it wasn't behaving. And it hated strangers from that moment on. And that's still common. Oh, I could tell you stories, Kelly, of the things people do to dogs commonly. I just heard a new one that even I hadn't heard of recently. And I'm appalled at things that are still legal, at least in the United States, to do to dogs. But the dog was completely aggressive, particularly to men. The trainer had been a man, so that's part of his stimulus package. And she was smart enough to know she was never going to train that way again. But the puppy had learned an important lesson. It was only a puppy, 6 months old, I think. And she determined that she would simply not date again until the dog died. It's both funny and tragic. It's like, oh my God, honey, you have to have a life too. There has to be something in this for you. But she loved the dog. When I worked with her, the dog was only two. So there was another 10 years at least, you know, like 10 to 14 years left in this dog's life. And I'm hoping she's happily dating or married at this point, but that was, cause that was a little while back. But yeah, it was, the owner, in my case, the owner, in your case, the families are so essential to the process, and you have to make them feel like you totally support them, not just feel like it. You have to support them. You have to be, not just their dog's trainer, but their like support network. You have to help them make some difficult decisions about how you're going to, you know, when it comes to dogs, their dog could die. So you have, and sometimes they have to decide that they're going to euthanize their dog because it's too dangerous. And so there's a lot of difficult conversations that you have to have. And you got to be on the owner's side with that stuff. You got to be on their side. And, you know, just keep them safe, keep them, you know, you want to help them manage it to the best of their ability. If their dog already has, a strong bite history, and I'm not talking little nips or air snaps. If you've got a dog that's biting people, you can have people in your house because he will bite them. If the dog has ever performed a really bad bite, like where damage, you know, really bad damage was done, there are times when you can't keep that dog anymore. There's going to be some legal involvement in some cases. In a lot of cases. And so we want to get to them before that. Unfortunately, they usually don't call you until they're in a lot of trouble. But you want to get in early. You want to teach them, like I said, these management skills. And then you want to teach them, you know, what's going on with their dog. Here's why this is happening. And here's what we want to switch around to give them a different experience. And it really is about, it's giving them control, giving them a different experience, and kind of helping them see the world a little differently than the way they're looking at it now. It's a dog that's aggressive is not a happy dog. There are probably times when it's happy or the family would have already given up on them, but the dog's miserable. So we're not taking anything away from them that they can have. I mean, I was talking earlier about the dogs in the landfills or in the streets in Ecuador, and they have so many choices that pet dogs don't have. They can choose to go the other direction. They can choose not to engage. And our dogs often don't have that choice. So we've got to teach the owners how to give them the opportunity to, like, how much freedom can I give them to do things that they need to do? Here's my cat, Kevin, who has come to visit me. In what situations can I give them freedom to do what they need to do? And how can I set that up? Which is a lot of that stimulus control stuff.
Yeah. And I want to come, there's one thing with stimulus control that I think would be interesting to talk about. But so how much extra like studying did you do to learn like dog behavior? Because I'm thinking, you know, going into like the animal sciences and everything and looking at, you know, what's common for dogs, you know, because there are just common responses that happen across. So did you spend time in that research as well?
Well, I did a lot of class. I went to tons of seminars. One thing that's really cool in the dog training world, at least before COVID, and now it's kind of all switched online like everything else, or a lot of it has, things are starting to happen in public, but there's a ton of dog training seminars and conferences. There's just a lot of them. When I started doing this, there was not, though, at least not in the area where I in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So I couldn't afford to just go out and travel all over the country and go to all these seminars. So I started hosting them myself. And I was just like, oh, I'd like to go to her seminar, but I can't go to Canada right now. I wonder if she'd come to me. And I found some places that I could rent to do these things in, and I would host my own damn seminar with some famous speaker. And so I did a lot of that. I did that for a few years, and I read everything I could get my hands on. I took, you know, obedience training classes and stuff like that myself. So I just really self-trained in a lot of that. But then you have to know your species, I think, is something that we tend to say, because reinforcement works the same with all the organisms, but what is reinforcing is not the same with all the organisms. So, you know, a neighbor came over and was surprised that my cats do some small tricks, and not very many, because they have the problem of the cobbler's shoes. I come home from work and I don't feel like training my cats, but they were amazed that I could train a cat. And I was like, you know, I can train anything if I just know what they like, or know what they want. If I can watch them for a while, I can train anything, but I have to learn what's important to them and, you know, what's important to them in a situation. So, yeah.
When I was teaching one of the intro classes at UNT, we would get to the topic of shaping. And I loved showing the weird animal videos that I could find, like goldfish playing soccer, going through hoops. Yep. And now, you know, when you start kind of like doom scrolling through your Instagram reels or your Facebook reels, like there's some really cool things that people are doing out there. And it's because they've captured what is it that maintains this animal's behavior. And it's not always food. Like some animals enjoy social. That's why the affection training is so important.
Affection training, yeah.
Yeah.
With a lizard or a snake, snakes don't eat that often. They don't eat all the time, but a warm rock can sometimes be reinforcing for a snake. I personally have not trained them, but I know other people who have. I know someone who trained an outdoor crow because the crow was being a jerk to her. I don't know if they had a nest nearby or what, but they would attack her when she'd go out to her car. And she did cat with them, with the crow, and it switched him around. But you know what else? We've done this with over 60 species that I know of. One of my favorites was a fruit bat. The big fruit bat, his name was Beethoven. He was in a zoo on the west coast. Lisa took me to the zoo there, and
she told the story last week.
Yeah it was so stinking adorable, and I got to meet Beethoven, and he didn't try to hit me. The training had been quite, they showed me what they did, but he had a look because I was new, but he was a very cool bat, a really big bat. That was really fun. But there's been a lot of species. Barbara Heidenreich does, she's worked with so many species, and she does a lot of cat stuff now. And it's really fascinating work.
Thank you.
All right, all right. If you are listening for continuing education units, here is the first of your two keywords. Your first word is away, A-W-A-Y. Reinforcement for some dogs was people going away.
Someone in the chat says they do cat with llamas. Which
That's where we started. That was where we started. The very first animal, Nicole Dory. Did you know her? She was at UNT, and she was, there were those llamas. There were these llamas out at the Gainesville Zoo, and they were supposed to be used for social, like to bring out around people. And, they were afraid. So she was tasked with training them to halter training them. But basically what you had to do was corner them and slam a, that's what had been happening. They'd corner them and slam a harness on them. And so they started with the very early, one of the early things with doing this type of thing, which we would offer. We'd stay at a distance. We'd offer a piece of, they liked yams. So we'd offer them yams. They would not come forward, but if they looked forward or moved forward at all, we'd drop it and go away. So I got to be part of that. And that was part of my interest in doing the aggression work too. But yeah, have you talked with, there's a cat in front of the screen. Have you talked with Eddie Fernandez?
Yes.
Cool.
We've met up a couple of times. So yeah. Okay. I think it's funny that Bob just said llamas are fun. Don't they spit?
Not, that's one of the advantages. They do spit. And it's the grossest smell. One time we'd been out at the zoo and somebody I was with had gotten spit on. The car ride back was miserable, especially for them. It was awful. But one of the things that you're doing when you're learning is to be a really good observer and to look and be able to tell when a llama is thinking they might spit. Because there's like all these, their ears go back and they, and it's the most disgusting thing ever. But they're really cool creatures. But yeah, they will spit. But you want to be able to switch the situation. Just like with any animal training, if you see a problem brewing, you want to change something up to divert that. And that's kind of what you do with llamas is learn what they're going to do before they spit at you so that you don't become the recipient. Of course, sometimes you may miss. I fortunately did not get spit on, but we did get up. She went ahead and was able to switch over. Once she got them where they would approach us, she went ahead and halter trained them using a clicker. So it was really cool. It was a really nice thing. And it was one of the precursors, experiments to what we did.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It was all very cool. Working at that zoo was a great opportunity. At the time, there was a director that was really supportive of what we were doing. And so we got to... do a lot of clicker training type things with little adorable tamarin monkeys and ostriches and sheep. And it was really fun. Somebody did something with a Kodamundi. It was, and the herd museum out in, where is it? Plano? McKinney, somewhere up there.
It's in North Texas area.
Yeah. They also had, I think they may still have students going there. So that might be somebody fun to talk to.
Oh, heck yeah. We've been able to talk to a few animal trainers and it's been really fun. Like if you haven't checked out, like Eddie's given kind of the history on how zoos and animal training developed, talking about the Breelands and Bailey and how influential they were. And then we had Laura come on and talk about dogs. Erica came on and talked about horses. So yeah, that's why the science is so cool, because like it's a four-legged animal. It's a no-legged animal and has scales. It has feathers. It's an organization. It's a system. Like like you said, the science is applicable. It's just, we are part of being the, you know, the scientist, the detective, is to tease apart what those layers are. And if I know what my organism is, then it's a lot easier to tease apart those layers, even though it sounds
I had a conversation just last week with somebody who has a PhD in a different psychology field. And he's like, how can you say it's just the science of behavior? And I'm like, because that's what it is. The reason we focus on reinforcement is because every organism responds to reinforcement, or it's not reinforcement, but every organism has reinforcing contingencies. And so we're all about teasing apart what those reinforcing contingencies are, and then what we can do to manipulate those reinforcing contingencies so that we can make beneficial behavior changes. Like with dogs, they're dogs, they're not people, despite what we commonly believe. And we make them live in a world that's not really natural for them. And we make them live in a world where they have to do stuff sometimes that they don't really want to do, just like us. I mean, we have to live in that kind of world too. I feel like that gives us a huge responsibility to make the world that they have to live in as fun and satisfying and comfortable as we can make it. Not comfortable in the form of you have to lay on the couch for 20 hours a day, but comfortable in the sense of the things that I do are meeting my needs. So
it's those degrees of freedom and how many choices do I get in these moment to moment basis, because, you know, as you know, a human, it's one of those, I make the choice of when I get up in the morning. You know, I make the choice of what I want to have for food, what I want to engage with, when I want to engage with, how long I want to engage with that thing. And yeah, when we start restricting it because it makes it easier for us, or because we're not paying attention to our organism, yeah, the organism's going to end up doing some things we probably don't like. Mocha was a perfect example of that. I was, again, the poor cobbler's children. She was horribly not trained. We had some reactivity towards other dogs as she got older. And a lot of that was because she was going blind and couldn't really see. And so it was just like, sorry, she's old and grumpy. That's why we get along.
Yeah. And there are times when you just, it's just like, it's fine. When you're, those old dogs, we let them get away with a ton because they're old, and changing their behavior now is not going to make a big amount of difference. So we're just going to accommodate it. But that's all in the animal training world. We're always thinking about management and training, you know, and there's kind of like a third leg on the stool is the behavior side. They look at training and behavior work as two different things. So behavior work is for problems, training is for new stuff. It's really the same enchilada. But, you know, that's where we get into, you know, the discussion of whether we should be using these four quadrants or discussing them the way that we do. We have these black and white judgments that positive reinforcement is always awesome and nothing could ever go wrong with it. Negative reinforcement is always horrible and you should always go to jail for that. And it's really, the way I break it down is, if I want to train something new that the learner has not done before, like I want my dog to go through these weave poles for agility, that is not a natural behavior that dogs are going to do. So I'm going to break that down into little pieces. Like first they go around one pole and then they, you know, and I'm going to teach them, I'm going to break that down into little pieces, and I can train that using a clicker and treats. Now, they don't have any history with weave poles. So I hope everybody knows what weave pulls are. They're it's an agility thing where there's a bunch of poles in a row, PVC poles, and the dogs weave in and out from each one, between each one, and they have to do it fast for competition. And so teaching them something new like that, that is not anywhere near their repertoire, or even teaching them something like lay down over there when I say down, teaching them specific things like that, that are new in their repertoire, use treats, use a clicker, use positive reinforcement. If you've got an animal, a learner that already has a problem in their environment, that's a persistent problem, you need, I'm going to say it this way, you need to look at what is making that behavior stay in the environment. Why is that behavior happening over and over? It may have started because the dog got scared on one occasion, and now he thinks that every person in a brown uniform from UPS is scary. We don't know. We don't even have to know why it started, but we know that every time they do their aggressive routine, you know, lunge, growl, lunge, bark, growl, lunge, bite, whatever their chain of behaviors is, we know that the UPS man is always going to go away. Now, the dog doesn't know that the UPS man is always going to go away anyway. Doesn't matter. The dog thinks that, or the dog doesn't, the dog's not even breaking it down this much, but the thing that does happen is every time they behave aggressively, UPS man leaves. So we know that we've got something, whenever you have something that they're trying to escape from or drive away or to have some relief from, we know there's negative reinforcement already happening that we, you know, in this case, the mailman or the UPS guy comes to the door, and we did not set up this situation to torture our dog. But it got reinforced with negative reinforcement anyway. And so we are going to do best to communicate with our dog by providing them with relief from the thing that scares them, that worries them. So in this case, to train with treats is to say, your worries are really not that important. It's easier for me to train with treats. Therefore, just look at me. I'll give you a treat when the UPS man comes. But we could switch that up and we could say, I can see that you're worried when the UPS man comes. So we can have a fake UPS man come and do some trials where he only walks away when the dog tilts its head or sits down or does anything appropriate that is not aggressive or dangerous. And then we're speaking his language. Then we're giving exactly what he told us he wants, what they told us that they want. They are telling us what they want when they perform this behavior to begin with. So if we can respond to them in their own language and say, oh, I get what you need, let me give you what you need, then we're going to have a whole emotional transformation that is not available when you're throwing in an arbitrary reinforcer. So, you know, giving kids, you know, I used to use this illustration where, okay, I'm going into a convenience store with my friend, and we're looking on the candy aisle because we're both have, you know, we both want chocolate, and this guy comes in with a gun, and my friend starts saying, Kelly, look at me, and starts feeding me M&Ms, and I'm like, get the M&Ms out of my face. There's a guy with a gun right there. That's what our learners are thinking. They're like, I don't want no stinking treats. They may eat them, but I think they're just eating them to get them out of the way. It's just like, or because they're on autopilot and it's just like, okay, this is happening. I've got to eat this so I can focus on the scary guy. And so we need to look at what reinforcers are happening in the real world for the animal, set it up so that we are introducing controlled aversives that we can show them are not going to be a problem. They're not going to hurt you. We're not going to let them hurt you. And show them, we get it. We understand you. And we're going to give you exactly what you're telling us you need. And that's the big nugget of it for me, is listening to them, responding to what they're showing us with their behavior, so that we can give them what's going to be the most salient, the most informative thing that we can, you know, the most informative consequence that we can, and say, yeah, you're having this problem. Well, now you can do this other thing and still get relief from your problem.
I like the using the term informative along with salient, because I know when I get stuck on, I'm like, you know, it's salient stimulus. Well, what does that actually mean? Informative. It means that both parties are understanding as to why this thing is happening at this time.
Yeah. So that I just feel like a lot of times in dog training, and for, I think it's pretty obvious why, because it's what we can figure out to do. But a lot of times we look at, what we can perform the most conveniently ourselves. It's easy to train with treats. It's not ineffective to train with treats. It's fabulous to train with treats. And even in the situation of aggression, there are times when using treats is appropriate. But if you are in the face of the situation where some contingency related to aggression is likely to happen, it's really valuable to be able to look at the animal and go, what is he telling me with this behavior? What can I tell him back that will help him not do things that are detrimental to him? He doesn't know what he's doing is detrimental. He thinks he's being helpful by getting rid of the UPS man. He doesn't know that if he were to go out the door and bite the UPS man, that I could lose my home. He doesn't know that. So we have to help them live in the world that they live in. And we're going to best be able to do that by treating the actual behavior in front of us with the actual stimulus conditions and the actual reinforcer. In this case, the reinforcer, the dog is not chasing the UPS man away because he gets treats for that. But we can make it so that he also chases the man away for treats, and because it makes the man go away. So why would we throw in that other contingency when we can say, oh, let's just use the man going away as the main reinforcer? It's a negative reinforcer. We're going to be training with negative reinforcement. I still get endless criticism because there is a term called negative reinforcement for giving an animal what he has told you that he needs. And I apologize because I keep using the pronoun he, and whenever I say that, I mean they. Okay. We need to be paying attention. We as trainers are, we need to be world-class observers. We need to be turned, I think, now Joe Lang would disagree with me, but I think that behaviorists need to take some courses in meditation of the type where you pay, like awake meditation, mindfulness meditation, proper meditation. Maybe I should teach a class on it for dog trainers. But it's not the kind of thing where you meditate and you zone out and you go into la la land and you come out refreshed. It's where you sit and you are very awake and aware of your environment. I cannot tell you how much that improved my observation skills with animals, because it gave me a place to go where I could stay out of my emotional head and just watch the world. Because we as trainers and parents and everything else have emotional heads. We go into emotion. So we need to teach ourselves ways to interact with the environment that don't involve us going over the edge. And that, to me, that's my personal opinion. That is not a behavior analysis opinion per se. A lot of behavior analysts have no use for that. But I think that the training it gives you really puts you over the top with respect to being able to observe well.
Mic drop.
That was my little 2 cents from left field.
Mic drops from Kelly. No, I think it's really cool. It's actually kind of a nice segue too into the discussion of like artistry and creativity, because we've had previous episodes where we've talked about utilizing theater techniques, utilizing dance and movement in art, and seeing how, you know, teaching something as behavior analytic principles and everything. And then there's this concept of creativity and how does creativity emerge? And when you, you know, when you have an art that you do, whether it be on stage or like with you and your painting, you know, it's those things still happen. Those principles are still there. You know, your behavior is being reinforced, mm-hmm. but at the same time, something that I've heard a lot of artists and writers say is like, I had this one image in my head, but then I started doing it and, you know, the story told me where it wanted to go, or the picture told me it wanted to look this way. And it's, we kind of anthropomorphize it, but it's that same concept of I'm still present. I'm being aware and I'm watching what's going on and I'm investigating, but I'm also just letting it flow. And so it looks like the behavior wants to go this way. Okay, well, let's follow it this way and see what goes on.
Yeah. Actually, something that I've been thinking about lately a lot, because I've switched my focus in my art. I've been primarily an artist for the last couple of years. And I was doing a lot of big paintings, which is what, you know, when you go to art school, which I did for a couple of years, they want you to do everything gigantic. And so I was doing some of that. And I was like, well, I realized as I'm, you know, it's like, I'm really excited when I start a new painting. I'm really excited. And so I'm like into it, and I've got, you know, I work on the design and the color palette and the blah, 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 blah. And I get into it. And then it's like, before I get to the end of the giant painting, I'm like ready to move on. And I really like the starting part. So what do I do? Well, I didn't do it naturally. I always kind of enjoyed working on smaller pieces. Well, I found this group of people. They're called Daily Painters. I found them on a podcast about art. And the person that started this or launched part of it, I don't know what all the details to the origins of it were, but they're Daily Painters. And she was a mom. She had toddlers in the house. She was a full-time artist and she couldn't get anything done. So she's like, okay, I'm just going to paint a little painting every day. So she started painting these 6-inch paintings, 6-inch by 6-inch square, teeny little tiny paintings. That is not big at all. And she popped them on eBay for $100 each. And they started selling like hotcakes. Because people can get original work, and she's really good. So she's selling these things. She and her husband ended up starting their own site. But basically what it amounted to, I was like, okay, you know what? I think I'm going to do that because I really like starting paintings. I just don't like working through all the detail till I get to that. So I was like, I can just do small paintings in between my commissions, because my commissions, I do whatever size people want. And that has another reinforcer attached to it, which is, I know money is coming. But with the little ones, it's like, I can do two or three a day. I can do one a day. But they're little. I'm always starting something, so I'm always excited. And I'm always finishing, which is another time when it's exciting. I'm finishing it. It's exciting. So I've like really amped my excitement level for my work up. And I can't stand it when I have a day where I don't get in the studio. I just love being in there. And it's because of breaking it down into bite-sized pieces. Now, I'm working on a couple of bigger paintings now because I've been hired to do them, but they feel less oppressive somehow, because I know I've got these little bite-sized chunks of reinforcement that are coming. And I can always, you know, at the end of the day, I can work on my big painting for several hours, and then I can switch over and do one little short painting. And, you know, that takes me an hour or two. And so I'm always meeting people that are like, oh, you know, I want to do art, but I just don't know where to start. I get artist block, you know, I look at the canvas and I don't know what to put on there. And I'm like, I know what they need to do. So I think I'm actually going to do a class on that, just like teaching them how to chunk things down into smaller bite-sized pieces so that it's not so overwhelming.
I volunteer as tribute, but for my writing. Because I do similar things. I love laying out like fun titles of things, or oh, this is a really cool phrase, I'd like to expand more on it, this is a cool concept. And then it's like, okay, now let's sit down and write about it. Yeah,
that's kind of how I'm going with writing about this, about Cat. Is like, I already wrote one book about it, right? I need to write a more professional, that was a pet owner's book, and some changes have been made in the procedure anyway since then. And I am like, I need to write a professional book, but it just goes into that not reinforcing phase because of the big chunks. I probably need to do exactly that, is chunk it down, make little tiny chapters, and just get it done.
But also there's this like little bit of hovering leftover stimulus control of like, I had to write a thesis on that. And they're not,
yes. I don't. The pressure. That's true. I didn't even think about it that way. That's true. It's like, oh my God, that was such a stressful time.
1000%.
Grad school. Yeah.
I felt very similar.
And the argument, working with dog trainers, a lot of them are some of my best friends. I adore dog trainers, but some of them are so damn argumentative. And doing some of this work kind of guarantees an argument, which I hate. And so that's another stimulus condition that I face. I just don't want to argue about it. I want to discuss it. I don't want to be called Caesar Milan because I use negative reinforcement. I want them to listen to how and why and in what situations. I would never use negative reinforcement to train a dog to sit on cue. I would use positive reinforcement for that. But if the dog is already responding to negative reinforcement that has been presented by the environment it lives in every day, and that is making the dog miserable, then I'm going to use the reinforcer that's already in place to help them learn new ways to behave in the world that are less aversive to them. I want to make their life better. And I don't want to risk adding another reinforcer to their problem behavior. So that's my two cents on that.
Not fully.
$2.
Yeah, it's definitely worth $2. you and I, and we've talked on several other episodes too about how, you know, as the science is the science, and it's, again, we just have to be mindful of what species or organism or organisms we're working with. And so, but it is also real easy just to chunk it as like, oh, it's behavior training or it's behavior mod, and put it in this little package when it doesn't fit neatly in a package, you know.
Yes.
We're constantly doing a dance back and forth. So like I've been cat sitting, and I mentioned last week that we've made progress where I had a combination of both cats. I had the aggression training, because she wasn't super like bitey, but the response was if I walked in the room, she would look at me. And I started gauging about how close I could approach before she would hiss. And if I got too close, she would swat. And so I'm like, okay, cool, man. So I'd walk in, look at her. And if she just looked at me, I was like, nifty. And I'd walk back out. And then we kind of started, and awesome. She actually flipped the script on her own of like, oh, again, you're listening to me, you're leaving. So now I'll grace you with my presence. Yes. And I would do kind of what Sean and Masa showed of like, I would just put my hands out and sometimes even two hands, I could see her kind of startle. And so, okay, nope, just one. And, you know, varying my hand position to see which one she prefer. Cause sometimes, you know, we would think like, oh, if she's coming in for a head rub, then I need my hand to do this. And it was too much, you know, she'd get a little overstimulated and she'd kind of bat at me and then she'd run off. And it's like, okay, nope, I'm going to leave my hand here and let you apply how much pressure you want and kind of direct my hand and everything. And so now I wake up and have a cat on my arm.
Yes.
And it was beautiful.
And that's beautiful. It's very natural. Yeah. I mean, it's working with aggression is a little more complicated, but it's like, you can incorporate this in every aspect of your life. Any interactions you have with other living beings, you can check out what is reinforcing their behavior. How do I switch that to a different behavior? How do I start? It's a differential reinforcement, but it's like, how do I switch this reinforcer to that behavior? And, you know, I just really like to stress that we're not doing it because we want to be mean. We're not doing it because we want to show we're alpha or we're the boss. We're doing it because the dog showed us what they need. And we're saying, oh, I get it. Let's work with what your situation is. I can't sit them down and say, well, look, here's what's going on. And actually, the UPS man is not here to hurt you. He's just dropping off some packages. And he was going to go away anyway. I can't have that conversation with my dog. So I have to show them. It's like, oh, if you do other things, he's still going to go away. So we work on doing those other things. And, you know, we may do it initially with a fake UPS man so that they can go away at the right moment, because that real UPS man is going to go away no matter what. He's going to go, he can't stand out there and help you train your dog, but you can train somebody else to be your fake UPS man. And the reason you would do that is not because I want to use negative reinforcement, even though I know negative reinforcement is evil or whatever. It's basically, the dog told me that this was already reinforcing his behavior. The way he told me was he behaved this way in the situation. And so now I, as the smart trainer, can look at the situation and create a training procedure that can help him. And that procedure may look a little bit different with each dog, depending on what their stimulus conditions are, what their trigger is, you know, who they're aggressive toward. You know, working with dogs that are aggressive to little children is super hard, because you can't just have a child out there in front of the dog. So there are definitely stimulus conditions where you can't do that, or at least you can't do it as easily. For example, I did a cat seminar last summer with Lauren Novak in New York City. And she was doing all the dog stuff, like all the hands-on stuff. And one of her clients was a small dog in New York City apartment that was reactive to people of all the places to live. They lived in a New York City building, and right outside their front door was a cafe, a sidewalk cafe. So there's tons of people around. So she couldn't even, the trainer couldn't even get into the apartment because the dog was so reactive. And so they had to resort to something else. So they did start, they used cheese and started doing some, I don't know if you're familiar with Leslie McDevitt, who's a trainer, but she does a procedure that I think is a great thing to throw into cat training when you run into a situation like this. But she teaches a procedure called Look at That. And basically you teach the dog to look at the aversive stimulus and not react. They have to, you know, they just look, they have to make eye contact. We want that. We want to know for sure that they know the aversive thing is there. And they get a treat for that. So they basically did that with that dog. And it was because they couldn't get far enough. They couldn't get far enough away. It, you know, a small New York City apartment, a busy New York City street. They couldn't get anywhere where there weren't people too close. So they really had to distract the dog with cheese. And so there are times when that's true, when you have to do that, when you have to come up with another plan. But when you have the opportunity, we worked with some other dogs with her where you couldn't exactly work on the street because of the crowding issue, but there are some parks around that are like fenced areas. I don't know you New York City very well, but there's some big parks that they were able to use. And so they did a lot of the work there. And those dog, that other dog was not aggressive, but instead fearful. Same thing applies. You can do the same thing with fearful animals, but instead of obviously getting rid of the aggressive behavior, you're going to get a, allow them to have relief from the aversive situation in exchange for not running to hide or not hitting the road. So any of those emotional kinds of behaviors that come from a naturally reinforced situation in their world, you can treat this way. And at the end, something that we haven't touched on at the end, well, I guess we have touched on it sort of, but they start, you mentioned it, they start changing their mind. You mentioned it with the cats. They're like, oh, she keeps going away. Maybe I should go check her out a little bit. And they kind of like start soliciting your attention in a way. At first it's tentative, and so you don't overwhelm them by going over the, oh, they like me now, and then you don't go scoop them up or anything. You let them lead the dance. That's that art thing. And you let them lead the dance, and then they start offering this appropriate behavior. We call that switch over. They might be calling it something different nowadays, but it was basically their whole attitude changed. It's like you turned from a negative reinforcer to a positive reinforcer. It's like you get conditioned as a positive reinforcer, which is awesome. It's like, I love that part.
But not just for one set of contingencies, because then we're not, then it's coercive. Like we've coerced that contingency. It's one of those, I know that I can get whatever kind of reinforcement I need from you, whether it's, I want you to go away because I want to be by myself, or I want to approach you and I want to engage. And so, yeah, there's all these new choices now that lead to, you know, the preferred reinforcer. And so it is, it's a great little dance and definitely effective. And effective with humans too. Like I said, I've been able to use it with some humans.
Yeah. Where was I reading something about, I can't remember where I was reading it, but it had to do with a nurse in a residential living situation. And there was I think it was a nursing home, you know, for elderly people. There was a crabby resident, just was mean to everybody. And that person, I don't know that they knew what they were doing was negative reinforcement. But basically, if that person was snotty to them, she'd just basically say, you know, you're not feeling great, I'm going to come back later. And she would just not not go down that road with her. She would always cut it off. And then because the woman was doing it to demand attention, she was lonely. And so it took a while to figure that part out, that she just didn't have, she wasn't using very good people skills, but she was able to reinforce this other behavior and help her see that, you know, you catch more flies with honey than by being a bitch. And so either she might've been trying to chase them, she might've been looking for alone time, I don't know, but it was just a situation where it happened naturally in a work environment with a human that was behaving that way. And she just was like, I'm not going to stay here and be part of this. So
I want to say it's one of Joe Lang and maybe Paul Andronis's cases. And you can, I think they're maybe in the blue books. I know they talk about it in the new nonlinear constructional book. But working with an individual who, you know, schizophrenic diagnosis, had a history of all this, you know, bizarre speech and everything, hallucinations, delusions, yada, yada. And so when they started kind of pulling it apart, what they found was, again, he wasn't using language that was communicated to other people effectively. So like another resident would walk in, and what this person had learned was, if I start talking about bugs crawling on the wall, and there are no bugs crawling on the wall, but I start acting like there are and I'm talking about them, this person leaves. And it's like, and it's beautiful. And it's like, okay, cool. So again, you know, there's, you know, diagnostically, there actually is a thing called alexithymia, where a person has the inability to tact those kind of emotional and physical sensations. And we see, and so that's how I look at it a lot of times is, you know, what, like you've said, what is this animal or the organism trying to tell me in this situation? And am I acknowledging it or not? Because you can look into a slew of psychology and counseling and rehab books and things like that. And one of the most important things they talk about is being genuine and honest and open with the person that you're working with so that they trust you. And it can get very mentalistic and fluffy, but it's one of those, if I'm telling you that I hurt or I don't like something or I'm uncomfortable and you just pat me on the head and tell me to quote one of my favorite other podcasts, cheer up, bitch. I'm probably not going to want to interact with you because you're not hearing me. Yeah. And so therefore I'm going to react in these other ways in order to get what I need accomplished.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And I think, you know, that can apply when I look at the dogs. It's like, you're giving me treats when I'm scared of something. You're giving me treats when I'm upset by something. And what I need right now is not treats. I need to know that I'm going to be okay. And it's the same kind of deal. And it's always, it really boils down to the two things. The big one, let's plan for teaching them something that's going to be more successful, teaching them alternative behaviors, but also a strong ability to look at the environment and figure out, you know, like people in, people with certain developmental disabilities that, you know, why is she chewing her arm instead of just let's put sleeves on her or, you know, let's block her in some way. What, you know, what does she do? Is she hungry? Is she needing attention? Is she, you know, does she not feel well? What, you know, look at her problem or whatever's causing this. Is she bored out of her mind? So it's the exact same thing. It's the same thing with dogs. What's the problem? What is causing you to behave aggressively to this thing in this situation? And what can we do to change things up a little bit so you know that you can do other things? Oh, that's so sad. And I can totally relate to it.
So the comment in the chat is, individual's wife is currently pregnant. She's on short-term disability and she's going through morning sickness and fatigue. Okay. Start getting better. And then, okay, now you have to go back to work. And then it just starts back up again.
Oh, I wonder if that happened to me. Cause I had a lot of morning sickness in my first pregnancy and it was a job situation. And, Oh, wow. I can totally sympathize with her. I hope everything goes well. And you know what? Rick Smith told a story in class. I hope I'm okay to tell this, but he was talking about when he was in high school and he started getting in trouble every day in a certain class. And he'd get sent to the principal again and again and again. This is Rick Smith, the PhD behavior analyst guy. Of course, he was a kid then, but he said, looking back, I hated that class and I would do anything to get out of it. I was acting out because I didn't have another way to get out of that class. And I'd rather go sit in the principal's office than be in that class. And that's negative reinforcement. So what they could have done had they known how to do it was go, what is it that he hates so much about this class? And what can we do to make it less aversive? Like change the teacher might be the solution in some situations. But so we do it ourselves all the time. We do it, you know, and it's no big deal that dogs, I mean, it's a big deal because it's dangerous, but it's a normal thing for us to do is to try to either escape or, well, in these kinds of situations, you're always trying to escape or avoid some sort of problem or something that you just don't like or that you're bored with or that causes you some sort of discomfort. And so if we can just look at those situations and go, what could we change up that would make them less miserable in this situation so that they don't feel like they have to go to the principal's office or they don't feel like they have to bite somebody. We've all been there. We've all done something along those lines. And it's just helpful to think about our own experiences with it and to really learn to look at that environment and understand a little step deeper what's going on than rather than I'm going to teach this child or this dog to do something other than aggression. That's a great way to start. That's a good way of thinking. I want to teach him another way of dealing with aggression, but to throw in an arbitrary reinforcer when we already have a reinforcer that we know is controlling the behavior that's part of the environment. You know, a lot of the challenge comes in because a lot of trainers, dog trainers, are pretty married to the idea that emotional behavior is always respondent behavior. And it's not. It's not always respondent behavior. So that can be a little bit tricky. But anyway, there are things we can do. There are important things that we can do to improve our lives. And it's all very constructional.
All right, cool kids. Here's the second of your two keywords. Your second word is choices. C-H-O-I-C-E-S. How many choices does someone get during their day? Choices.
I think it's a beautiful like sum of the last couple of hours is, you know, being constructional, not taking things personally, exploring your own experiences and delving a little bit deeper. Because again, you know, as developing humans, you don't have the language from the get-go. You're taught language. You're taught how to tact things and what this, you know, when your stomach makes this gurgly sound and you feel like you want to throw up, that means you feel sick. Like those are all things that we're taught. And as you develop, you know, other things start to kind of fall in with them. And so sometimes you get some weird chains of behavior or things like that, but it's always worth exploring it and looking to see, you know, what was that critical consequence, that critical maintaining variable that kept this behavior going? And you know, now what would we have done differently? Like, yeah, we would definitely look and say, okay, if it's just this one teacher, do you need to see that teacher? There's so many other things. Like when we talk about being least to most intrusive, you know, least intrusive is tweaking the environment. A lot of times it's a whole lot easier for me to change something in the environment than it is for me to go, okay, new friend, or old friend or whatever, but like, now we're going to teach this and we're going to teach this and I've got to write a program and we've got to do a reinforce. And like, that's a lot of time right there. Whereas let's tweak the environment, see what happens. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it could be so many things. Is it too hot in here? Is it, you know, do they just not like me? You know, is there something I'm doing? Is there a cue, like you were talking about your laptop being a stimulus for a bad time, you know, from his point of view in that situation? And there's always that stuff. It's just neat to be able to look at it in terms of breaking it down like that. There's a situation, behavior happens in, and then there's something that happens as a reinforcer, as a consequence that keeps that behavior going. And that always is consistent. That is consistent. So we can always look at that and break that down, you know, if we're just aware of it.
It's the choice. And I don't know, I like to be a detective. I always wanted to be Sherlock Holmes. So now we get to play that. To kind of be mindful, because I mean, oh man, we've touched on a lot of things and I'm so excited because I like to talk nerdy, and it's always great when I get to do so, because I get to learn.
It was so funny. It's so thanks. Fun.
So one thing that I would like, as a last, you know, whatever, if you want to, any other thoughts that you want to give out. And then if you could also, if people wanted to reach out to you on social media, you know, where can they go? How can they find you on the interweb?
I am you can reach me by email at hello@kellysnyder.com. And my name is spelled weird, so I think you may be able to see it in my corner there, but it's K-E-L-L-I-E. SNIDER.com. Just hello@kellysnyder.com. All of my Instagram and everything is really art related. So although I'm getting ready to switch to behavior art, I don't know how I'm going to do that, but I'm going to be talking about behavior and with respect to art a lot more in the future. So if you are interested in that, you can look at Instagram at Kelly Snyder Art, or also on Facebook, I'm at Kelly Snyder Art.
Apparently I can't type and do other things at the same time. My brain just like totally focused in. I was like, I need it. And then all of a sudden my brain went, you have to put it in alphabetical order. You can't just put Instagram, Facebook. It has to be Facebook, Instagram. Anyway, sorry about that. Happy brain. It's okay, but we love our brain. It's good. So yeah, thank you again. This has been absolutely amazing, and I appreciate everybody for hanging out. I hope you enjoyed it. You know, feedback is always welcome. You can hit us up again. It's a verbal community is something that we also really want to have as part of our mission, that people get in touch with other people and they have these conversations, because learning to experience life through other people's lenses is vitally important if we're going to continue making progress. Like, you have to be able to drop your biases and your subjective opinions and social constructs that you may have learned. And sometimes it's painful to do that. Like, it's tough to be called, you know, have someone argue with you about how you're practicing, but it's like, okay, but they also have their own perspective and they have their contingencies that are in place. And so we just kind of take that step back and go, okay, I see what's maintaining your behavior. And if I want to engage further, I can, but you know what, for my own mental health benefit, I don't think I will. So, but yes, if you guys want to have, you know, always engaging stuff, feel free to hit us up on the social medias. And other than that, I love you all, beautiful humans. Be kind to each other. Be kind to the animals. Go forth and make somebody's day and be awesome. And I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes. Hello, beautiful friends. Thank you so much for sticking around. As promised, here's a preview clip from our next episode. Give it a listen and we'll see you soon.
Hey, this is what the research told me to do. The research, I did this. It didn't work that way for this particular client. And like, here's what I did to change it. And here's what worked. Because that information, the mini experiments and the day-to-day research that practitioners are doing would be super valuable to the faculty and other researchers in the labs who are doing this research that's supposed to inform practice, right? So there, it needs to be like the cyclical relationship where, you know, research is informing practice and then practice is, you know, seeing what happens when we put this into the messy applied world.